Thanks very much for joining me. I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. Today, my guest is attorney Dan Stidham, author of the book Harvest of Innocence, The Untold Story of the West Memphis 3 Murder Case. This is part one of a two-part series. Dan Stidham is joining me today. He is the author of the book Harvest of Innocence. Thanks for joining me, Dan.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
We're going to go back in time about 30 plus years. And Dan, I'd like for you to kind of take as much time as you need, but I want you to paint a picture of the circumstances that were presented to you with the opportunity to take the case, a murder case that some said was an open and shut case. What were the circumstances that brought you to this particular case?
It was a phone call out of the blue. I remember about a month earlier when I got that phone call. Of course, the little boys went missing on May 5th, 1993. And I was at my mother and father's in Little Rock. And my dad and I had just come in from fishing on the lake. And then there was a breaking news report that came on the TV, and they were talking about they had located the bodies of 3 8-year-olds. And almost immediately there were these rumors that were being reported as fact that there was sexual mutilation of the three little boys. And people began talking back and forth about satanic ritual cults and satanic ritual homicide, which happy to report, there's no such thing. There's not a single case ever reported on the planet of satanic ritual homicide. So the thing I remember most about that day is my dad shaking his finger at me and saying, whatever you do, do not get involved in that crazy stuff. You have no idea what you're getting into. And I said, there's no way, Dad, I could get involved in that because I'm too far away from the crime. I'm just about as far away as you can get geographically and still be in the same judicial circuit. And so don't worry. And about a month later, I had to worry. I got a phone call from Judge David Goodson, who happened to be on the bench in West Memphis that day. And it was his task to appoint lawyers for the three teenagers that were accused. And it seems that no one wanted to represent Mr. Miskelly, the young 17-year-old who had confessed. And so apparently there were people on this driving in droves to represent the other two, but no one wanted to touch the kid with the confession. And so I thought, well, this judge thinks enough of me to call and ask me to perform this task. As my immediate reaction was no, and then I began leaning towards that way. And so I asked the judge if it was okay if I called my law partner and asked him what he thought about it. And he said, sure, you got 20 minutes. And so I tried to call my law partner and he didn't answer the phone. So that was back in the days when the phones were hanging on the wall and not in our pockets. So it was a little bit different time. And so I decided to do something that I knew would get me out of this precarious situation that I was in. I asked my ex-wife to come in the bedroom where I was on the phone, still dripping wet from the shower, a towel wrapped around me. And I explained to her as fast as I could, because I was running out of, my 20 minutes were about gone. And I told her what was going on, and she said, do it. This is what you do. This is why you went to law school, and I think you should do it. And it shocked me because I thought she would really talk me out of it. And so I called David Goodson, Judge Goodson, and said, I'll accept the task. And at that moment, since I had heard there was a confession, I assumed that my job was going to be quick and easy. I would just prep my client to testify against the other two. And at that point, I'd be in and out pretty quick. So I thought it might be a good way to build my practice, get some experience, and do what I do, which is defend people who are defenseless. And so that's why I got involved. And the thought of my father telling me not to do it never even entered my mind for some reason until he brought it up a couple of days later. Why did you do that? You told me you weren't. And I said, well, things happen. And but again, I thought it was going to be a real quick and easy situation. And I realized fairly quickly that this was a trip that I hadn't completely packed for. And here we are 31 years later. And this case has never, ever left the spotlight. It's been in the news perpetually and probably will stay that way. Just like the Salem witch trials that happened exactly 300 years, I should say, almost to the day of the Arkansas witch trials in West Memphis.
So you decided to take the case against the wisdom of your father, and you were encouraged on by your ex-wife to take this case. So take our listeners to your very first meeting with your client. Describe your client, the circumstances and the environment around that encounter that you had first with your client.
Yes, I got a hold of, well, before I start that, I should say, I read my client's confession on the front page of the largest newspaper in the Mid-South, the Memphis Commercial Appeal. And of course, it was horrifying. But I got a hold of one of the other defense attorneys, and he had acquired a copy of it, and he faxed it to me before our meeting with our client for the first time. And I was reading this thing, and the one thing that jumped out at me, the first thing that jumped out at me, was how horrific the description of the injuries and the sexual assault, and it was just horrifying. And then I reread it, and I thought, you know, that couldn't have happened that way because the little kids were in school all day till 3 o'clock. So there's no way this happened at 9 in the morning or at noon, as Mr. and Ms. Kelly had said. And I also knew that the little boys were last seen riding their bicycles on the service road very, very near where their bodies were recovered the next day, and very, very near a huge parking lot for a 76 truck stop. And so it just didn't make any sense. And I thought, we got to clear all this stuff up, you know, and this is going to be difficult. So my partner and I loaded up in the car. We took my legal assistant, one of my two legal assistants, Vicki Crosp, and we took off to Piggott, Arkansas, where I had him move to for my convenience because he was in the Cross County Jail and it was just too far. It was a 3-hour round trip drive. And Piggott was only about 35 miles away. So all the way there, I kept thinking about, you know, I've seen his mugshot. He looks like a big, tough kid and had this strange haircut, kind of a cross between Gomer Pyle and Mr. T. It was odd, to say the least. And on the way there, I kept thinking about an interview I had seen earlier of Charles Manson and how crazy and wacky he was when he was interviewed. I think it was by Diane Sawyer. And I thought, is that what we're going to get? And, I couldn't figure out what to expect. And when we got to the jail and got signed in, the jailer took us down this short hallway. And he led us in what's called, in most jails, the common area where they eat and watch television and things such as that. And there at this concrete table sat this very, very small young man. He looked like he was about 9 or 10 years old. And I thought maybe they had put us in the wrong room. And I said, are you Jesse Miss Kelly? And he looked at me briefly. Most of the time he kept his head down to the floor. And he said, that was about the only thing I could get out of him. And so the last thing I wanted to do was put a tape recorder in front of him, because I figured he'd had enough of that after 12 hours of interrogation by the West Memphis Police Department. And so I started going over some of the inconsistencies in his statement that I knew conflicted with what really happened at the crime scene. And the biggest thing, of course, was which one of the children had been sexually mutilated, because there was only one of the three that were. He got it wrong. Completely wrong. A couple of times throughout our interview, I asked him, you know, are you sure it was the blonde kid? And he said, no, it was, or he said, yes, it was definitely the blonde kid, in which it wasn't. I knew it wasn't. I had yet to see the photographs of it, but I knew that it was not going to be pleasant to look at. And so basically, it was just the opposite of what I expected. I expected to see Charles Manson, and I got Jesse Miskelly. The jail uniform that they had him in, the orange jumpsuit, was so big that he had to roll the sleeves up just to find his hands and his feet. So as we were about to leave, my law partner, Mr. Crow, reached out and put his hand on Mr. Miskelly's shoulder, and he just recoiled in terror. Obviously a very frightened young man. I gave him $5, I believe it was, get a real haircut before he went to court. One of the things I noticed on his arm is he had a tattoo, and the tattoo said WTF. And I said, what does that mean? What's that stand for? It was a homemade tattoo. And he said, F the world. And I thought, oh, great. That means long sleeves for the courtroom. I said, do you have any more tattoos that I need to know about? And he opened up his jumpsuit and displayed where someone had tattooed the word bitch. That's a quote. I'm not trying to be profane. And I said, why would you do that? And he said, I don't remember, which I thought was very strange and odd. That was kind of the end of the meeting, and my law partner and I got back out to the car, and it's like, what just happened? How are we going to prepare this kid to testify against the other two? There's something terribly wrong. At that time, there was no such thing, or no one believed the concept of a false confession, and I started doing some research through a private investigator that agreed to help us on the case. He provided me the name of a forensic social psychologist from Berkeley, who not only specialized in cults but also specialized in false confessions. He gave me a New York Times Magazine article about Dr. Richard Offshay, and I took it with me and I read it, and I thought, you know, with my background in sociology and psychology, this actually makes sense. So I got the nerve up to finally call Dr. Offshay, and was expecting him to say, well, if you'll pay me $15,000, I will be glad to come and help you with the case. And instead, I was met with, I'm very interested, and please send me a copy of the transcribed copy of the confession, along with any of the officer's notes that you've gotten in discovery, and I'll take a look. And I said, I don't have any money to pay you. I want you to understand that up front and make it clear that we'll have to wait till the end of the trial and ask the judge to award you a fee. And he said, I could care less about that. This is research for me. This is what I do. And I said, well, thank you very much. And so a couple of days later, he called me back, and his tone had changed. And he said, Dan, this is the stupidest effing confession that I've ever read. Your client is innocent. There is no question about it. And of course, that was music to my ears, until I realized that suddenly I'd gone from prepping a young man to testify against his co-defendants to now going to trial. And I was 30 years old. I was a public defender in my local county, which was Greene County in Paragould, where I live. And I thought, The worst thing that could happen to a lawyer just happened to me. That is, I've got an innocent client. And that was a shocking event. And Dr. Offshay flew out a few weeks later and debriefed Mr. and Ms. Kelly. And I waited outside in the lobby of the jail waiting for this to get completed. It was about 2 hours, I believe. And he came out and said, okay, let's go. And we took off back to Paracold from Piggott, Arkansas, and he didn't say a word. So finally, I just pulled over on the side of the road and stopped the car and said, well, tell me, what do you think? And he said, Dan, your client's innocent, absolutely innocent. There's no question about it. This is a false confession. And I said, well, have you ever been qualified as an expert in false confessions before? And he said, yes, once in Oregon and once here in Arkansas in federal court. And I thought, here we go. We're going to make this happen. So he asked me to read a book by an Icelandic homicide investigator. His name was Gisli Gudjonsson. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's a very difficult name to pronounce, but I read his book cover to cover, and it really began to resonate with me just how innocent my client was. The thing that I noticed was that he could never tell the story the same way twice. If we sat down and asked to tell us what happened that evening, he just couldn't do it. It was different every time. And what he was trying to do, I found out later, was remember what he had told the police. In fact, he thought we were the police. He didn't understand what a lawyer was, which puzzled me. I'm the kind of lawyer that I start at the top and work my way down when it comes to experts. And so I called Park Dietz's office. And Park Dietz became famous as a forensic psychologist and for his work in the Jeffrey Dahmer case for the prosecution. And I called his office, and the receptionist said, he can't speak to you until you send the retainer fee. And I said, well, how much is that? She said, $15,000. And I said, I don't have $1,500. That didn't work out too well. Dr. Offshay had told me to obtain the services of a qualified polygrapher because the West Memphis police had given Mr. Miskelly a polygraph exam just prior to his confession. I started at the top. The gentleman on the other end of the line on the phone call had no intention of getting involved, was not interested in getting involved, but I used my charm and at least convinced him to look over the polygraph charts and point me in the right direction and maybe suggest someone who could help me. And very gruff and very grumpy gentleman. And so I sent it to him. A couple of days later, he called back and said, your client passed the polygraph, even though they told him he was lying. The confession is ridiculous. It's not accurate. It couldn't have happened the way he said. He didn't share anything with the police that they didn't already know. So he agreed on his own dime to fly out to Arkansas on two occasions, once to testify at the suppression hearing and again at the trial. So all of a sudden I was batting, 500 at least. Or maybe 1,000 at that point.
Yeah, sounds like 1,000.
Sounds like 1,000. Yes, it does. And my polygrapher from Miami, Warren Holmes, called back and said, here I go, we're coming. And so all we liked at that point is forensic psychologists. We looked everywhere. Nobody wanted to help us. Nobody wanted to get involved in the case. I remembered working with a gentleman who was a psychologist from Jonesboro, which is where the second trial was held. And I called him up, and to my surprise, he said, yeah, I'll take a look at this and interview Mr. Miss Kelly, and I'll help you out. And so suddenly we had a psychologist. So then I was batting 750. So So I thought, I've actually got a chance to pull this off. I really think that I can win this thing because I've got these experts who are world class. And our psychologist said that Mr. and Miss Kelly was on the borderline of intellectual functioning, but that he wasn't mentally retarded, which is the term we used back then. Today's jargon is MR, which is a much more softer, kinder, gentler way of saying mentally retarded. Due to that, the state was permitted to implement the death penalty if Mr. Miss Kelly was found guilty, which was a frightening aspect for a very young lawyer who had never tried a jury trial as first chair before. This was actually my first jury trial.
So let's walk in. Let's take our listeners inside the courtroom as you are now at this point ready to present your case. How did it go? What happened? Take it away.
All right. Well, the first thing that happened before the trial was a documentary team showed up from New York, from HBO, and they wanted to film the trial and film us as we prepared for trial, which I wasn't particularly enthused about at all. In fact, all the defense teams, all three defense teams, objected in the law in Arkansas at that time, and it still is today. If any party objects, then the judge cannot allow cameras in the courtroom. But this particular judge was so narcissistic that he thought that cameras were important for his benefit, and he allowed them in despite our objections. And after a few days of trial and suppression hearings and all the other pretrial hearings, I began to realize that if it wasn't for these cameras in the room, we wouldn't have this thing documented the way it needs to be for eternity. And so I was very happy that they were there. And so by the time we got to trial in January of 1994, of course, the prosecution puts on their case first, and they didn't have a case other than the confession. They had one witness who corroborated Jesse and Damien's. She said she went to a witches' meeting with them. And of course, we could never find anyone who had participated in that. And she said that Damien had drove them there, and he had never had a car, didn't know, even know how to drive or have a driver's license. So we found that interesting, and there was a $35,000 reward, and I just assumed she was after that. And of course, if you put almost 300 pictures of three dead 8-year-olds at the crime scene and during autopsy, the jury is going to want to punish someone. And so it was a very difficult task. And then something completely unexpected happened. Judge Burnett would not let my clients, or excuse me, my experts, testify as to their theories of the case. Of course, I was unprepared for that because Dr. Offshay had been qualified as an expert before. Mr. Holmes, the polygrapher, had been qualified as an expert on dozens of occasions across the country. And he just cut them off at the knees and wouldn't let them testify.
May I just ask, on what grounds did he disqualify them?
He said that he had already ruled that the confession was voluntary and was admissible, which is not the way our law or our jurisprudence works. He decides whether legally the confession comes into evidence. He's not the ultimate decision maker on whether it's a true confession or not. And we argue that incessantly for about an hour. Finally, and it's in the record of the case, he said, "Well, what the hell do we need a jury for?" And it was loud enough for the jury to actually hear it because the courtroom was so small in Corning where we held the trial. The only thing I could do was make a proffer. And the judge ordered the jury to the jury room, and I put Dr. Offshay on the stand, and we put on our case. And it was very, very revealing and very, very powerful testimony, but the jury never got to hear it. And so after we proffered that, and the reason we call it a proffer is because it's not introduced into evidence, but the appellate court will get to see it to see what the judge would not let in over our objections. And so we brought the jury back in, and the judge had set certain boundaries, and I could only ask certain questions of my expert. So it was very, very frustrating. When the jury got the case, they were out. It was about 10 o'clock at night, I believe, when they got the case after arguments. And at midnight, they asked if they could go home and come back the next morning, which they did. And then it got to noon, and they still hadn't come back with a decision. And the sheriff of Clay County had actually told me that the first vote in the jury room was 4 votes for acquittal and 8 for conviction, which I didn't ask him how he got the information. I didn't want to know. But looks like we had some people who were actually considering the false confession defense. And even though they didn't hear Dr. Offshay's testimony, everybody in the courtroom did. Most of them were journalists, and they came up to me after Dr. Offshay's testimony, and they said, "You just won the case. This is amazing, testimony. It's clear that your client's innocent." And I said, "Well, the jury's not going to get to hear that." At noon, the judge grabbed me and the chief prosecutor and went back to the jury room, knocked on the door, and asked them what they wanted for lunch. And the jury person who ended up being the foreman told Judge Burnett that we don't need any lunch because we're almost done. And then Judge Burnett said something that I'm still horrified by to this day. He said, "Well, you're going to have to come back after lunch to do the sentencing anyway, so I'm going to go ahead and order you food." And I thought, he just told them what to do. And the foreman looked at him and said, "Well, what if we find him not guilty? Do we still have to stay?" And Judge Burnett was so shocked, he just shut the door. And I looked over at the prosecutor, and he was just pale and about to faint. And so I immediately reported what happened to my co-counsel, Mr. Crow. And we decided that if we asked for a mistrial, we were going to get it, and that we'd have to try this thing over again. And if the jury came back with, we found out later that they were going to acquit him, we would never be able to live with ourselves.
We will pause our interview segment here and continue in 7 days. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.